Welcome to the Diecast, everybody. I'm Seamus, and with me this week is Joshua.
No, I'm not. I'm not here. You can just ignore me. Just edit me out, actually. I probably don't have anything interesting to say.
I was going to do that anyway, but thank you for the permission.
I stole your fucking joke.
And also here is Chris.
Hello.
Edit him out, too.
And who else is here? Rotskarn, are you here?
Yeah. No, actually, surprising everyone.
And Mumbles? No? No Mumbles? Aw. I think it's been, like, several months since Mumbles and Rotskarn were on the show at the same time. You guys have been tag-teaming. Or you are the same
so
person. If we want to reintroduce that running
joke.
It turns out that
Rotskarn and Mumbles are actually the same person. Sorry, guys. You finally figured it out.
You are the Bruce Wayne to her Batman.
You just need to keep saying that, and Mumbles will appear. Like, she'll need to defend her name. It's like in Baldur's Gate, when you name your character Drizzt-do-Urden, and then you get an evil reputation, Drizzt-do-Urden actually shows up to fight you. That's exactly what it's going to be like.
Can you actually kill him? Because I would fucking play through an entire Baldur's Gate playthrough to murder Drizzt.
Him and all of his fucking cronies. You know, Wolfgar, Caddy Bride, all of them.
Fucking Forgotten Realms, man.
Josh, did you mean fucking fiction written with people's actual Dungeons & Dragons characters as heroes?
Yes! That's what
It's the worst, he said, writing a novella about one of his Elder Scrolls characters.
Very loose.
Hypocrisy level. Epic.
But that's why in Adventurers, I'm sure to make Kamel just, you know, he's just kind of like an anxious, spineless coward in a lot of ways. Which he is in the Let's Play, too. But it's like, you know, I really wanted to, you know, like, he has plenty of redeeming qualities, but I really wanted to get away from that whole, like, glorifying all of those hours you spent playing role-playing games thing, which a lot of, you know, D&D authors have going for them.
So this week, we are doing the mailbags. The whole thing. We're going to do as many as we can, because apparently, the less emails we answer, and the more we ignore them, the more people send. So in order to stem the overwhelming flow of emails, we're going to try answering them, and then maybe you'll go back to ignoring them.
Which is interesting, because we said we were going to do that last week. And I'm pretty sure we said we were going to do that the week before, too.
Well, our mistake is, hey, we're going to do all mailbags, but first we'll introduce ourselves, and then we'll talk about what we're doing lately for the first 10 minutes of the show. And then that turns into 40 minutes.
So I've been
playing
Dark Souls, it turns out.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on! First email. Dear Diecast. As a popular saying goes about first impressions mattering the most, I'd like to hear you guys' thoughts on coming back to a game after trying it out, after disliking it at first. I recently finished a playthrough of The Witcher. You know, as I was parsing the first sentence, the first game that came into my mind was The Witcher, and then I get to the second paragraph and they bring up The Witcher. I recently finished a playthrough of The Witcher a couple years after I first tried it and found that it didn't mesh with my loot-hoarding playstyle at the time. I ended up enjoying it much more than I thought I would after breaking my pack rat habits and leaving behind any incinerators. In quotes. Love to Josh. Any personal thoughts or experiences on second impressions? Love you guys. Steven from the Midwest.
So, Do you want to go, Rotskarn?
No, because the thing is, I absolutely have done this, and I can't fucking remember it. You go first.
Okay, so I recently did this with Dragon Age 2. Because I had this idea in my head around, like, late November, early December, that I was going to, like... I was going to, with Dragon Age Inquisition having just recently come out, I was like, yeah, I'm going to write something for you know, to put on a blog to well, let's be honest, to steal Seamus's blog and give him content for free. Cause I hadn't done that in a while and I wanted to get back into the writing gig. And I thought, yeah, I'll do like a retrospective of Dragon Age, of the Dragon Age series up to Inquisition. And then I'll do like a review of Inquisition. This kind of got sidetracked because I realized that I didn't actually like Dragon Age 2 or Inquisition all that much. And I say that, but I also want to say, like, I kind of don't hate Dragon Age 2 like I did before. So, like, I played Dragon Age 2. I pre-ordered Dragon Age 2. I think Seamus had exactly the same experience that I did with this, where I pre-ordered Dragon Age 2. I got it. I played it. I even wrote about the demo, and I said, like, hey, they finally fixed the stupid dialogue wheel that Mass Effect does by not making your responses good, neutral, and evil anymore, which I think was, good. I mean, they kind of replaced it with diplomatic, sarcastic, and blunt instead, which kind of works better, but doesn't. But I got the game, and I played through most of the first act, and I was like, I don't want to play this game ever again. The combat was, I thought the combat was, just, it was boring. It didn't have anywhere near the sort of tactical nuance that the first game had, and it upon reflection still doesn't. And the story was, up until this point, basically, hey, pay us money to go to the deep roads. And I was like, that's not something I actually want to do, thanks.
That really is like that's the equivalent of, in a 90s shooter, having you do a side quest, a really long side quest, and give up your best weapon so that you can go into the sewer level. It's just asking a lot for something that you know you don't want to do.
Now that you're saying this, Josh, it's actually making me think, because I had a very similar experience. Like, I started Dragon Age 2, and I don't think I even got as far as you did. I was very, economical with my time with that game, where I was like, okay, that's it, that's enough. I got as far as, they make the decision to drop you in as cold open, with you having no idea what's going on, where it's your you don't even get to customize your character. They just, give you one, a default character for a combat part. And, the best part of the Dragon Age games is that the combat is good. God, it is combat. And then it sent me to character creation, and I could not make a character who looked like a human being, so I just went with the default, which I wasn't really happy with. And then, I have two conversations, which are also kind of a cold opening, because it's starting in the middle of a catastrophe, because all Bioware games do that now for some goddamn reason. I don't know.
Didn't work for me. Feels very marketing-driven. I mean, this is not what old Bioware would have done. Old Bioware felt no shame in throwing you into a character creator, and, hey, you want to dick around with some skill points, and do you want to think about stuff, and here, have some cutscenes for an opening, and here, wander around for 10 minutes before you actually fight anybody. But no, now it's like, we begin with combat, and then you can begin play, and then you begin the game proper. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like, even...
But Knights of the Old Republic started with, your ship is on fire, and you gotta go save Bastila!
Knights of the Old Republic started in the middle of that catastrophe, but firstly, it begins with a very long conversation that you have, where you could ask him methodically, where am I? Who am I? What's going on? And since it's Star Wars, the answers are actually really straightforward. You pretty much know what's going on instantly. I have not played a Dragon Age game since the first one, where I've started the game and felt like I had a decent grip on what I was fighting, why I was running, or why everything was fucked.
Yeah, exactly. Star Wars needed less explanation, and they gave more, and you got it before they expected you to care about who you're shooting.
Yes, before you ever...
Yeah. And even then, they dicked around with, hey, here's how to pick up items, here's how to loot, here's, you pick your character. So they absolutely did. That was a long, involved opening by the standards of the day, I would say. Certainly not, it didn't begin with you already in combat with one of those troopers, and then somebody shows up to talk to you, and then you make your character.
Yeah. I didn't actually have that problem with Dragon Age 2's opening, because Dragon Age 2's opening, if you have just played through the first game, Dragon Age 2's opening, pretty much explicitly states very early on that it's happening during an event that happened off-screen in the first game. So that was, okay as far as the connection goes. I was able to figure out where I was pretty quick. And I kind of remembered that detail, but I can definitely see that if you haven't played Dragon Age Origins in the past 6 years.
Or if you're like me and you just forgot the first game, and just when you went in you were like, I forget this whole world, but I seem to remember it had something to do with dragons.
Yeah, I never loved, I don't think I've loved a BioWare setting. like an original setting ever. Like, they always feel kind of like...
Jade Empire I loved.
Okay, I haven't played Jade Empire. I think I would be ready to love that game, but like the Mass Effect and like with just like the Reapers and then like Dragon Age, the Darkspawn. It's always felt to me kind of like a kind of stiff, boring, melodramatic universe that's melodramatic in content, but kind of mundane and by the numbers in practice. That
you should play Destiny.
It feels kind of like Destiny,
if you think the Reapers and the Darkspawn are bad, try the Light and the Darkness and the Traveler and the Speaker.
Well, like it's a perfect example. Like the Darkspawn are a more perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's like they have a unique name and they have like a unique origin and like backstory and like thematic stuff and lore, which is all, like,
but
completely different
orcs
and buried. But in practice, they're fucking orcs. In practice, it's an orc. It's like an angry, big, ugly dude who looks like he was made by a bored CGI studio with no art direction, who was asked to make a big, scary humanoid monster. And you fight them, and they fight like orcs, and they go, rawr, and they raise their arms up in a warlike fashion, and they charge you. And in practice, it's so boring. It's like, I would absolutely rather have orcs. Just have orcs. Because then I don't need to worry about it. Nobody's gonna try to spend 20 minutes making me care about them. They're orcs. I know what they are.
Nobody's gonna explain to you what an orc is.
Yeah, and maybe they'll have some fun subversion or something. But like, I have that going already. I don't know. Yeah, I would actually prefer having a completely unique enemy of some kind, or like an enemy that is in some way interesting. Like, if the Darkspawn were actually super brilliant, and like, occasionally you'd capture one and it would speak in riddle. And they had like these weird gold braids coming off of their head, and like these glittering jewel-like eyes, or something, just anything, just don't make them fucking orcs.
So, we've now strayed way off topic, but
oh my god!
You know, as we are wont to do,
5.3 seconds.
To listen to something straightforward and on topic, what the fuck are you doing listening to this podcast?
I can answer my version. I can answer my part of that question really quickly, by the way, because I thought of the game. It's Saints Row 2. I bought Saints Row 2 back when none of the other Saints Row games had come out, but like Yahtzee liked it, and that convinced
back
people
before
who
the first game.
Yeah, no, like back before Saints Row 3 and 4 and Gat Out of Hell and shit. But like back when it was like Yahtzee liked it, and that's the first thing that convinced a lot of people that maybe the Volition wasn't just doing like the Thug Life thing. And I was really allergic to that kind of media at the time. So I got the game and I played through the first few levels and I'm like, this is it. I'm just like a jerk ass and I'm shooting people and I killed a bunch of cops and broke out of jail. And there's this big grim city. And the first thing I see is like gray sky and a gray building and a bunch of pimps. And it's like, I don't actually know if I give a shit about this game. And oh, I have to go to like a thrift store called Sloppy Seconds. Yeah, this seems really fucking stupid. But I don't know. I mean, I played a little more of it, and I realized just, like, the level of insanity in the game, and I realized I actually kind of liked the direction of the cutscenes. Like, I liked the sort of the action.
Saints Row 2 is interesting in that way. Because, like, Saints Row 2, the insanity's there, but it kind of, it's a little more coy about it. It doesn't, like, throw it all at once at you. Whereas Saints Row the Third was, like, from the very start, from the first second of the first cutscene, everything is wacky and bizarre.
It's weird, right? Because I think Saints Row 2 is this weird melding point between what the leftover, because originally Saints Row, and to some extent Saints Row 2, has a lot of that Grand Theft Auto style sex pun 14-year-old humor.
Saints Row was straight just a clone of Grand Theft Auto 3, practically. You know, it was very much just a mediocre Grand Theft Auto knockoff with no sense of humor.
No, it had a sense of humor. It had Grand Theft Auto's sense of humor, like the sort of passive
okay, so
everything's
like, with no sense of humor.
you know what I mean. It's like everything's a sex joke, everything's a pun, and not even a fun Rutz Garden pun, but like pick the most obvious sex pun you could make, and that would be what a store is called or whatever. And then Saints Row 2.
I was just going to say, I think people expect that I just love all puns, but I actually really fucking hate forced puns. Like, I hate that more than anything.
Really?
Yes.
You don't say, Rutzkarn.
Physician,
you hate
heal
puns.
Thyself.
No, I mean, like, newspaper headline-style puns.
Oh, yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, continue.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think my point's been made, is just, you know, Saints Row 2 is the first point where you start seeing the glimmer of, like, going beyond the... taking the Grand Theft Auto everything is a joke and sort of taking it to an extreme. You see that a little bit in Saints Row 2 with like the poop truck, the sewage truck. But then by Saints Row 3, it's gone full crazy. And although I guess Saints Row 3 still has a little bit of the meanness left because it's still got like the human trafficking missions and a few other unsavory bits. But by Saints Row 4, it's just full on like, let's take these characters we love and just have goofy fun with them. And I love that slow progression from like cheap, crappy GTA knockoff to really finding its own legs and its own voice. And you can watch that progression over those four games, and it's really cool to do that. I don't know. I'm late.
Yeah. All right, Saints Row 2 is like, to give you an example, Saints Row 2 is like a whole third of the game is this like, oh man, Johnny Gat's girlfriend got murdered by the Yakuza in a super brutal scene that was really sad. You gotta go get revenge. And then you're fighting the Yakuza, and they're all dressed in like yellow tracksuits for whatever reason.
And the capstone of all these storylines is always really dark. When you kill the bad guy, it happens in a cutscene, and it's brutal death. This is not, haha, I push him off a building and he dies. It's always like somebody gets buried alive, or you kill one of their loved ones or something.
I think the Yakuza plotline ends with you like impaling the Yakuza boss through the back with a katana into the floor of a boat with a bomb on it and then leaving him to blow up. My memory might be a bit fuzzy on that one, but I think something along those lines happened.
Yeah, it's like just really grim, brutal shit, like murder pranks.
Anyway, again, we're way off topic. So I played through Dragon Age 2 again. And I noticed that some of the things that I thought were pretty bad, you know, I didn't mind that much. First time through, I had trouble connecting with the characters, and I really especially didn't like what they did with Anders, who was, like, this completely different character in the Dragon Age Origins expansion pack. He was, like, basically, like, an Alistair stand-in, because you couldn't have Alistair because he was, like, either dead or a drunk or the king. And then in Dragon Age 2...
That was like Schrodinger's spoiler there.
Okay, so if you haven't played through Dragon Age Origins yet, you know, it came out like 7 years ago, but if you somehow haven't played through it, you shouldn't listen to that last segment.
Thank you.
Dragon Age 2, like, you could almost make the argument is like, Anders is the protagonist of Dragon Age 2 and not Hawk, because everything seems to revolve, like, all of the like, he's the prime mover in most of the action. But I didn't like what they'd done with him initially, but having played through the game again, like, I got kind of on board with it after a while. And I didn't, the combat lacked tactical depth, which was the big thing that stuck with me playing through it initially, and it still kind of does, but that didn't bug me too much. What bugged me much more about the combat was that every fucking fight is like three waves, and the game is not balanced for that very well. I started out playing the game on hard, and by, like, the end of Act 2, I had just dropped it to easy and never looked back because, like, all the fights just took forever. And I was like, yeah, I could beat this fight, but I don't want to. I want to just plow my way through all of these combat segments because I don't fucking care anymore. There's way too much combat in that game. And I ended up liking different parts and disliking different parts from the way that it was when I first played through it. Overall, I still don't think it's that great of a BioWare game, but I can kind of respect it for what it tried to do.
Quickly, I had the exact same experience as Rutzkarn, in that I played Saints Row 2 and thought, oh, this is like a dumber Grand Theft Auto clone. And then I was literally bored and out of games. I came back, played it again, because people kept talking about how much they liked it. I think it might have been, for me too, it might have been Yahtzee's review, where I was like, whoa, I could be an Englishman with a bowler hat, and, you know, and I made my own crazy character, and, you know, you ran around subverting the setting, and then I fell in love with the game. And the other game that I hated first and then came back to was Bulletstorm. It was the same thing again, like, it's constant dick jokes and haha, let's shoot these guys in the butthole. Joking around really, really pissed me off. Just was so tedious. And for whatever reason, I came back to it later, and maybe I just have appropriately lowered my standards, but I was like, you know, you know what? I think it was after a few years. There were years between these two playthroughs. And maybe I just had too much Grimdark, and the stupidity of Bulletstorm seemed refreshing after so much Grimdark that I was on board with.
I think what made Bulletstorm swearing work for me was that it didn't feel like it was trying to appeal to an audience. It felt like an aesthetic choice. Like, these guys just swear all the time, and it's not because they're Marines, and it's not because we want you to think they're mature. It's just literally these characters. That's what they do. They just expletive, expletive, expletive every 5 seconds. And I'm like, I can live with that. I can live with the fact that these characters just swim in swearing. Like, the whole universe is bathed in it. Anyway, for me, I was like a PC gamer nerd in my formative years, so I was real into, like, you know, Half-Life and Counter-Strike and all that, and Quake 3 and all that jazz. And I went to high school between 1999 and 2003, and then I went to college between 2003 and 2007. So I, for the longest time, absolutely loathed Halo as being like the dude bro Mountain Dew drinking, popped collar, you know, frat boy video game multiplayer shooter of choice, like the sort of faux bro gamer thing. Because I was, you know, I'm into the real games. I'm into PC games like Half-Life. Because I was, I don't know, 16, and I was a horrible person. And, you know, and I'm like, nothing can ever be worse than Half-Life, right? He doesn't even have a name. He doesn't have a face. What kind of character is Master Chief? The story's all told in books outside of the canon. Then Call of Duty came out, and suddenly I realized that maybe this really, really epic sci-fi adventure that got a bunch of people into nerdy stuff like spaceships and ring worlds and you know, time dilation, maybe that wasn't such a bad thing compared to just rah-rah shoot dudes. And I don't even hate Call of Duty anymore either. That's the other thing, is I've mellowed with age and I'm not sort of like, yeah, it's all stupid because it's popular. So I went back and played through Halo.
It's stupid because I don't like it. Yeah.
Exactly. And I went back and played through...
I had the same attitude and I was 10 years older than you. So, I have even less...
I went back and played Halo 3 when it finally came out and was like, cheaper than it originally was, and I'm like, this actually plays really, really well. And I got really into Halo 3 for a while, and then sort of started reading up on the lore. And I'm not like a Halo expert, but I'm now Halo and I are pretty cool. We're cool. We're not best friends, but I still play the crap out of Destiny, and I bought the Master Chief Edition of Halo, so me and Halo, we're good now.
How's that one working out for you there?
The Master Chief, the real interesting thing with the Master Chief Edition of Halo is, and I should probably do like an errant signal on it, is like comparing it to Destiny, because it is readily apparent. Like, if you ever want to talk about how certain studios can have a design aesthetic or a style, Halo and Destiny are really close. And not just in obvious ways, like, I mean, obviously, like, the Needler, it still kind of exists in some of the bad guy weapons in Destiny and other stuff like that, but like... There is a point where you're waiting for Cortana to open a lock, and she's like, you know, hold on, I've got to open a lock, and then a door opens and bad guys come, and you kill a bunch of monsters in the ship, and then Cortana's like, oh, you finished killing the bad guys? Cool, the door's open now, but I don't know how long it's going to be open. And it's like, that's Destiny. That is straight out of Destiny, and they just have not moved on.
So what they did was they said, like, hey, that one time that happened was really cool. Let's make that the only mission in the entire game.
Well, it's not just that. It's like... Other little things, like being able to get vehicles where you don't think you should be able to get vehicles. Like, you can drive a Warthog into places that the game is clearly not intending you to drive it. And you can do the same thing with the little speeders in Destiny, where, it, like, just stuff like that. There's little, also very, very big, epic techno scenes, techno scenery, techno vistas, I don't know what you'd call them, but like, you know, like where you're in the Hive underground on the moon and you can look over those big empty spaces where it just drops and you can't even see the bottom. Halo does that crap all the time too. Just certain visual flair stylings that are the same between them. The little Hasbro baby toy look of the Arbiters sort of matches the sort of plasticky Hasbro toy look of the Fallen. Lots of stuff. I could write a thing on it. And now I've digressed. We're really good at this.
I know. Okay,
yeah. So let's see. That's 30 minutes, and we're one question in.
Of like 12 questions.
Yeah, let's fucking diecast our fucking mailbag episodes, right?
So this is going to be a 6-hour show.
Yeah, let's do it.
Hello all, I was just re-listening to Diecast 81 about PAX when I heard Josh bemoaning a lack of video game conventions in his native Las Vegas. My folks moved near Las Vegas, and while I was making plans to visit them, I discovered there is the Level Up Expo in May, which appears to be a gaming convention held at the end of May. Would Josh known if this expo is worth a detour to the city? Or if this is the first time it is being hosted, would Josh have any recommendations for visiting that part of Las Vegas? It's being held at the Cashman Center. Thank you for your time, Jesse.
So
I've never
heard of the Level Up Expo before today. So I have no recommendations as to whether that's a good thing. I mean, looking at their website, I don't know. It doesn't look like they have any panel schedule up yet or anything. Like if you click on the panel schedule button, it goes to the hey, submit an idea for panels. So I don't know if it seems like there's going to be a lot of support there, but
see if they have a ball pit, dude.
I mean, the website looks nice, and they've got a bunch of console tournaments, but the Cashman Center is just north of the like old downtown Las Vegas. That's where Fremont Street is. So if you want to go to like check out like all the old like 50s casino locations and that kind of thing, it'd be right next door to that. So that could be cool. It's also not very far from the Strip. You know, it's like a 5-minute drive from the Strip. So if you just want to go and hang out in the casinos and go check out our, I don't know if it's 1-to-1 size reproduction of the Eiffel Tower. I think it's something like 2-to-2/3 scale or something like that. I don't know, but we've got an Eiffel Tower, we've got a Statue of Liberty, we've got a castle, with a roller coaster in it. Those are fun.
It's amazing what you can build with billions and billions of dollars from people who are unwise with their money.
Yes, when people give you their money and you are not obligated to give them something good, it's amazing the wonders you can construct.
Yeah, I mean, Las Vegas is a cool place to just, like, come and check out at least once.
I was about to say, and Las Vegas is a cool place to just, like, bilk thousands out of their hard-earned cash in building a monument to excess.
Yes. Don't actually gamble here. It's not a good idea.
No, but it's bad for you. I don't like to scold people or tell you that your habit is wrong. I hate when people do that. I don't like scolding culture. But I would advise, gently yet strongly advise, against putting any money into any of the gambling facilities there in town. That's Seamus's advice to you.
He prefers you go put all your money in Atlantic City.
Yeah, this help way the East Coast out. Atlantic City, you know, they could really use some help. Actually, they really could. I've been to Atlantic City. It's not a pretty sight.
Okay, next one. Dear Rutskar, a few diecasts ago, you said the best way to get you to GM a season, to get you to GM a session was to just hang around you for a few months until you were setting up a new group. The rest of the cast seemed disappointed that you hadn't done anything with them. Is there any way you could do something live-streamed playing some kind of RPG with the crew? It would be fun to watch. Peace, Hammer.
Did we actually seem disappointed that that hadn't happened? Because it actually
Chris has seemed disappointed before, twice.
Actually.
There's two problems. One is that we're all very busy and have different schedules. I particularly lately, you know, I've been working on my novella series for Patreon. I've been cranking out adventure novels once a month. Venturing novellas once a month. I'm not quite, like, not quite to that level of prolificity.
You're not Stephen King. As,
yeah, I'm not Stephen King. I would know if I was Stephen King because...
This is basically it for us for the week. Like, this one evening, Saturday night, when we all meet, this is practically the only time we can meet. And if it doesn't happen, we don't make content that week. Because it is just impossible to get us all together. Because we all have jobs. And some of us have families.
Yeah.
Me and Josh... I was just going to say me and Josh struggle just to find time to play Destiny. And that's just the two of us during the week.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I would actually really love to run a game for these guys. And we even had, I think we mentioned before, we even had a Fallout game, which we had together, and we made characters for it, and we played a preliminary session. And that's when we ran against the other problem as well, which is, okay, so I'm, like, gonna come out and say it. I'm a really good DM. I am very good at doing that. It's one of the things I've done over and over again over the course of the years. But I am terrible for some reason at GMing online. I can't do it. Like, my rhythm is all wrong, I spend too much time narrating and not enough time, like, letting people play their characters. It isn't clear to people when I'm finished and when they should, like, or, like, you know, the way I put it is, like, unless you're just interrupting me every sentence, you should be able to interrupt me whenever you want to make an action. But I lose that rhythm when people can't see me and, like, sort of take my visual cues. I'm not good at it.
You can't
I don't
read
give
their
people...
face, yet you...
Yes.
You can't read faces. That's the killer. I know exactly what you mean. You don't have somebody's face. You can't get a feel for if they're into this. Do I need to hurry through this? You know, you introduce somebody and you start talking for this villain and you have no, the other people online are all quiet and you're like, are they quiet because they're in awe of this guy or are they just pissed off or bored or are they playing solitaire or Minesweeper in another window? Just, you have no way of knowing. And that's, like, essential information for being a good GM.
And that's the other thing. I mean, under normal circumstances, I have a zero-tolerance policy for people just noodling around in a game, like, on their phones or on a computer or something. And, like, I don't actually speak up always because, it doesn't happen very often, and, B, I'm not very assertive in general. If it's happening when you're playing, like, on a online game, it's like, well... but maybe it's not their turn, or maybe they're just not interested in the scene, or, you know, like, well, it's just so hard to police that I don't, you know. The bottom line is, if I could get all of them in a physical room on a regular basis, I would love to do that, and I would stream it. And, you know, I mean, if we could get one thing together sometime, I would really love to do that. Maybe with webcams or something. But, you know what, it's until that stuff comes together, it just can't happen. Maybe like a one-shot Mist Gate or something.
We should all just play Cards Against Humanity. That's what we should do.
Except the online Cards Against Humanity is terrible.
Do you really want to play Cards Against Humanity with me, Campster?
I actually don't. Yeah, I see people post pictures from the game, and the game strikes me as... It always feels very mean and ugly. Like, just...
Yeah, it is.
Like this really spiteful sense of humor. And maybe that's just the ones I've been exposed to. But that's how it feels. It doesn't feel like a kind of game I'd like.
The game is very much like it sort of... I actually saw an interesting review. It was on like a Christian gaming website. And they actually gave it a very positive review. And the way they put
it
is like...
Whoa, you just blew my mind!
Yeah, no, I mean, the way they put it was that... it's kind of like, you know, the way that humor of that game works is, which card do you have that's most appropriate for this thing, where everybody can see it and make the connection and laugh? And, like, you know, you feel like you have a lot of license to make jokes you wouldn't want to make otherwise, because, like, oh, hey, I only had 10 cards to work with, I just had to make the cheap joke, right? And you sort of get at a deeper level of sort of, like, unspoken prejudices and unspoken thoughts and, like, you know, feelings. And it's not as terrible and degenerate as that makes it sound, like where you're becoming your worst self, because most of the humor is not like, and most of the cards are not like, you know, racial stereotypes or something. They're just like, they refer to concepts or things, or like political structures or, you know, cultural artifacts and debris. And I don't know, there's some really interesting moments with that game. And actually, one of the negative things about it is that it's very hard to play if you're not American, I think. I mean, you know, if you like are adjacent to American culture, I think it translates pretty well. But I actually played it with Arvind while he was in the U.S. I say played it, but we actually just like drew hands and made combinations. And I had to like sort of explain a lot of the, like in many of the cards and many of the sort of the plays. Although a lot of it he just got. Anyway, that's okay. My Cards Against Humanity degree.
Dear Diecast crew, the spoiler oracles. It looks like the U.S. interest in PC games are waning every year as they focus more and more on consoles. Meanwhile, European, mostly German and Russian developers are not only creating some great PC titles, both AAA and indies, it actually seems like it is the strongest gaming market over there. Considering Valve is barely a gaming developer anymore... Yeah, that's true. When was the last time they shipped something? Do you think that Europe and Russia are going to overtake the PC market in the coming years? Your Brazilian fan, RCN.
So...
Not particularly.
I guess, like, I can see why you would get that impression looking at the media from the outside, but I don't think that the PC market has actually been winning in the U.S. very much. If anything, it's been getting bigger.
Yeah, no, I certainly don't.
Yeah, I'm playing more PC games now than I did before. It's just there's less AAA tentpole games and a lot more indies. So does that mean it's smaller or does that just mean it's more diffuse?
That said, I dig a lot of what the Eastern European and Russian studios are doing. So I'd love to see them do more stuff. You know, I loved Metro and I like The Witcher a lot.
I think to some degree we're just seeing sort of the death of the, like, big monolithic studios for PC releases. We are seeing, like, you know, I think we're seeing studios that are a little more modestly sized working on stuff for PC. And I think that is kind of something that's been, you know, I think we're getting to a point where we can see successes from a lot of different places now, and not just like, yeah, we can see, you know, indie successes from here, you know, and modest studio there, and it's not all just, you know, crowded around California or whatever.
Yeah.
Although I say that, and I literally live within driving distance of like 6 or 7 major studios.
I thought most of the studios were up more in like Silicon Valley, San Francisco area.
They're everywhere. I mean, that's the thing. They're just kind of like... Like, the Irvine area is kind of like a mini Silicon Valley for a lot of STEM stuff.
They're like potholes.
Silicon potholes. Yeah. Those are the only potholes you'll find in Irvine. A couple things you will not find in Irvine that cannot exist in Irvine for more than 5 minutes. A cheap ethnic food place. Homeless people. Potholes.
Irvine is like this weird, bizarro mirror universe anyway.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, actually. Oh yeah, dark patches. There's this weird thing about Irvine where anywhere a person can walk is at its absolute darkest, bathed in this kind of surreal orange light, which looks like dusk. No, it looks like sunset almost. Like, that's the darkest things ever get, is like, once I remember when I was in college, I looked outside my dorm room after waking up, like, early in the year, and I'm like, oh, geez, is it, like, already 6 a.m.? It's, like, sort of a glowing orange out there, like, the sky is a glowing orange, and it was, like, 2 a.m. It was just that, like, the millions of street lamps on the clouds made it look like it was sunset.
Yeah, you know, like, light pollution in Vegas is bad, but at least I can see the stars if it's clear outside at night.
Yeah, like, you don't see the stars in Irvine.
Weird. Okay, dear Diecast, with another potential graphic generation upon us, what do you think of how previous graphic limitations seem to have become full-fledged art styles, like 8 and 16-bit inspired, the occasional FMV, etc.? Do you think early 2.5D and 3D graphics will get a similar treatment? That's a really interesting question. In that vein, do you have games of that era with art that you feel holds up today? The N64 Zelda games are abstract enough to feel the same to me, for instance. Thanks for the thoughts. Jakeo.
So, like, early, like, second generation 3D, like, Quake era, N64 era, PlayStation era 3D looks really, really bad.
Like, it if looks you compare, really good.
Disagree. I disagree, Josh. I love it.
No,
To make it clear, what I'm talking about is chunky models and lo-fi textures, not necessarily the Quake aesthetic. I am not arguing in favor of Rivet City. I'm arguing in favor of really chunky models. I love those old models.
Though. Like, compare, like, any game that came out in 1998 that was 3D to any game that came out in 1998 that was 2D, and you'll find that the 2D has held up a hell of a lot better than the 3D has.
What about lo-fi polygonal art indie games? What about Fract OSC or the friggin' Shelter or that game that is being made by the...
Those don't, like, scream early 3D to me, though. In the same way that, obviously, 2D platformers are obviously trying to channel, like, Mario and Sonic.
Well, just today on Reddit, there was that Strafe game that is made by a bunch of guys that they're trying to make it look like a 1996-era shooter. Did anyone else see this?
I mean, I saw the headline about it, but I haven't actually seen the video of it.
It's a retro shooter that is trying to be retro 3D. I don't know. Anyway, my point is, well, I really do love the lo-fi, low-poly look. Right now, I think my favorite version of that is, the guys that made Dust Force are making a new game, and it looks just gorgeous, and I can't remember the name of it. Let me Google it real fast.
While he's Googling it, I will say some of this might be prejudice on my part because in the 90s I was a graphics artist and I spent a lot of time working on low poly stuff, and I really appreciate good low poly work. There is some art. It is a blend of art and engineering, which is why I loved it. Great low poly work is like Ocarina of Time, and bad low-poly work is the Thief games. Or Morrowind. Yeah. Morrowind also you'll see people do fan-made patches. I saw one of Morrowind where somebody actually reduced the poly count on the base models in Morrowind and made them, at the same time, look way better. So there's a lot you can do with low poly work.
Well, I mean, it's Bethesda.
Well, that's the thing about Bethesda is that they're famous.
Wait, when was the last time Bethesda
Bethesda's
put out
famous for
art?
Making the best use of their polygons in art design? That's the thing I love about holders. Bethesda games is that all Bethesda games have just these simplistic art styles that are nonetheless make the most of their limited materials. No, Bethesda is no just takes these expensive resource hog machines, and they just hand them to fucking toddlers to piss all over.
Right, but
I should not have just called Bethesda's artists toddlers. I don't know. Something's not coming together, and I actually suspect that it's very talented people who, for some reason, their work is just not being directed together in the best way.
Yes, but that thing where you can reduce the polygon count of something and make it, at the same time, use less resources and look an entire graphics generation newer. I love that sort of work. I think that's wonderful. I love any time I get to see it, and I really appreciate it. I love Ocarina of Time. I love when the camera zooms in and you realize, holy cow, that guy's face is like 4 polygons, just perfectly divided to, you know, give this guy a characterized shape. Like, it's not like everybody has cube heads, but they make these stylized heads using just the bare minimum number of polygons, and it's wonderful, but maybe most people don't appreciate it, and they don't care, because, you know, they didn't spend a couple years of their lives obsessing over vertex positions and polygon counts, trying to get their model down from 200 polygons to 180, and wondering where they're going to come up where they're going to cut 20 polygons from.
You know, I didn't realize you'd ever actually played Ocarina of Time.
Okay, I played a little bit. My kids have played a lot of it.
Okay, so the game by the Dust Force guys, who are Hitbox, are making a game called Spire, which looks absolutely gorgeous. It's very Wind Waker-y, low-poly, with some gorgeous, gorgeous textures on top of it. I did a video on a game last year on a game called In the Kingdom, which was a 2.5D shooter made last year in 2014. That game looked gorgeous. Then there is...
I don't know if I'd use gorgeous. It looked really interesting. I don't know if I'd use gorgeous on that particular style. Yeah, distinctive.
I would say is... I don't know. I get...
But go ahead, Campster.
Well, and then there's all of Blendo Games stuff. Everything Brendan Chung does, like Gravity Bone and 30 Flights of Loving, which is sort of a Quake 2 era that uses the Quake 2 engine, actually. Lo-fi, low-poly look, which I adore that. I keep harping on about it. Glitch Hikers is sort of a not even texture shaded low poly 3D look. All these games to me are just absolutely gorgeous, and I eagerly await any lo-fi 3D, low poly 3D. I cannot get enough of it.
I don't look back at Jedi Knight and think, yeah, that looked good. So I guess like nostalgia has something to do with it.
No, I was just going to say nostalgia might factor into it as to sort of predisposing me to liking that sort of aesthetic. But I think a lot of it is you can't look at it as there were ugly games back then, because there are ugly games now. I can easily point to hideous things that use the latest 3D graphics that are still kind of just sort of like, ugh, whatever. Like, you have to look for... Like, Mario 64 still is gorgeous, and Mario 64 is hideous, blurry textures, super low-poly, super low-fi, but it still looks really good. Same with Wind Waker and other games. You have to look for the game... Like, I think Quake 1 still actually looks really good. I mean, I know Seamus was kind of making fun of it for being Rivet City, and it is that. It is kind of like Hot Topic spewed out all over your first-person shooter. But that's sort of what I like about it, is that it feels like a very distinct art direction. It's all blue and gray and a little bit purple and rusted and decaying, and you get a real sense of place, whereas something like Doom doesn't have that sense of art direction. Doom actually is... I mean, I love Doom, but it is kind of ugly. It's kind of mishmashy, whereas Quake feels very directed, which is ironic, because as a game, it was terribly directed. But
yeah. I also, the other wrinkle here is mixing tech levels, like something like Sword and Sorcery, Sword and Sorcery, where you've got,
Sword X, Sorcery.
That's right. It's like, it's high def and it's got these lighting effects, but then it's got these ridiculously pixelated, like, not even 1990 level. Like, pre-1990 level pixelization.
They look like the sort of things you get where, like X-Wing had stuff like that. X-Wing and TIE Fighter had stuff like this, where they would, like, you know, they would hand-draw everything. And they might use, like, reference images from, like, the movies, and hand-draw a copy of that using, like, a limited palette and everything, which I don't know. That's something that gets my nostalgia, because X-Wing was like the first video game I ever played.
So I love mixing levels, like instead of going back and like, okay, we're going to perfectly recreate the Nintendo aesthetic. It's like, what if we created the N64 polygon count and texture density, but then we threw modern lighting on top of it, so you've got like lens flares and shadows being cast. Like, when stuff like that happens, it always tickles my brain to see.
That would look really fucking weird.
I love it. I love it. And another thing I'd love, like I've been thinking about this all weekend, is what would happen if you went back to like Virtua Fighter level graphics, where the bodies have like maybe 300 polygons in them or so, but then you give them modern animation sets. Like a Batman kind of, Batman or Prince of Persia, where you've just got these super complicated, nuanced animations playing on top of this super low poly model. I'd love to see it. And unfortunately, animations are hard to do, so that's not something an indie could do, and that's not something a AAA developer would do, so that particular experiment I don't think could ever happen. But I would love to see Lo-fi models with modern animation sets. I think that would be brilliant.
Another aspect that we haven't really talked about here is pixel art has, like, retro in big scare quotes, pixel art has not become the norm necessarily because everyone actually wants to make a pixel art game. Like, if every indie developer had infinite money and resources, they would not all be pixel art games. They would probably not all be platforms right. either. It's I don't want to say it's easy to do pixel art because, like with any art, there's a lot of depth there to really do it well. But it's fast. You know, if you were to say, like, yeah. hey, I want to hand-draw the animations with, like, rotoscope-style, like, Disney animated movie-style animations for all the characters in this game, you'll probably spend, like, 2 hours on each frame of an animation. You can nail one of those in, like, five minutes with pixel art.
Is the lowest barrier to entry.
And when you have no money, but you have a game inside of you that you just have to make, that's where you're gonna go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think people don't think of this sometimes about, like, how, you know, how many specific skill sets it takes to make a game that is firing on all cylinders. You know, for an ideal game, like, you need to have a very good artist, like, somebody very good doing music. If it's got writing, the writer needs to be really good. All the parts of the design need to be tight and fluid. And to have one person who could work independently in their basement on this and hit all of these things perfectly by themselves at a high level, that's just very rare.
And to take that a point further, even if you're doing super low poly 3D stuff, any kind of 3D engine is going to be more complex than a 2D engine just by default. There's a lot more things that you have to think about when you're doing a full 3D engine than you have to think about with a 2D one. You have to think about, like, cameras, you have to think about various rendering techniques and, you know, polygonal models are
the camera. The 3D creates a need for a complex camera. The complex camera creates the need for complex controls.
Yeah,
and so it just spirals away from you at that point. And complex controls can create the need for more complex gameplay. Like, hey, why do I need two thumbsticks now? This game had better be deeper or more robust to make it worth all this extra effort I'm putting into it. You know. So, yeah, it sort of demands more on every level. And you can't just play a 2D game in 3D. You can't just easily jump from one to the other. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And the other difference is, like, making intentionally lo-fi, low-poly models is not any particularly, like, faster or more efficient than doing, like, more middle-of-the-road 3D models that, like,
yeah,
look
it's probably good-ish harder.
By today's standards.
Yeah, it's probably more time-consuming. Because hitting a specific polygon count is... if I tell you this needs to be... I want a guy and he's got to be 300 polygons, and, you know, you come in at 350, it's like, oh, shit, now it's going to be a couple more hours of work to get him down into the budget. So... yeah, it's more work if you're really going to do it
right.
Of
course, I mean, I imagine that, like, if you were trying to do a retro game, you might not have necessarily super hard polygonal limits like you did
with,
if you were trying to make it for the hardware of 1998.
That's a really good point. It's like, okay, I want it to look like 1998, but you can go ahead and if it comes in at 1,000, who cares? As long as it looks like it's 300.
But it doesn't have that, like, pixel art dynamic of just being, like, so much faster to develop. So I think that when you see a retro 3D game, that is, like, a very deliberate choice on the part of the dev team, whereas a pixel art game, you know, maybe that person didn't really want to do pixel art, but they couldn't find or couldn't pay a dedicated, like, full-time artist, so they were like, okay, I'll do pixel art, and they got good at doing pixel art and were able to nail the whole pixel art aesthetic for the game. But a 3D game, like, that's specifically going for a retro 3D, like, you already have all those elements where, like, yeah, we could just do this with decent-looking 3D models, and it wouldn't be any like different as far as time investment goes, or not significantly. I mean, I guess you could say, like, if you're good at doing low poly modeling, you could probably do lower poly models faster, but it's not as significant as the difference between like doing 2D pixel art versus doing 2D any other kind of art.
There's a question I wonder about. Chris, when you were at your college thing and they were teaching you about that, did that sort of thing ever came up? I know you were in for programming, but did you ever have any classes that deliberately challenged you to do the kind of work you would have done 10 years earlier? Like, okay, I want you to write a program, but, you know, you can only use 100K of memory.
Not with hardware requirements. The closest we came was there was an elective of assembly, but that's like, eh. Like, it was an assembly class, but it wasn't like, here's a machine from 35 years ago that has the 56K of memory. It's just more like, let's teach you the basics of assembler.
So is that like you were writing for a specific processor or just like in general at that point?
It's generalized enough that you don't need to know that. At least we didn't have to buy any specific machinery for it. It was pretty chipset agnostic. Right. You had to talk about, you know, stuff like big Indian processors and that sort of thing, but we didn't have to, like, you didn't have to get a specially assigned computer just to be able to program the language.
Okay, that was a good question. Like, I feel like I could do an hour on that question, but I'm worried of like, just running it into the ground. Another thing that might help is if we had some more, just to digress on this a little bit more, pixel art anybody could do. But if you want to do 3D, well, where are you going to go? You don't want to write your own engine, so you're going to go to Unity, and Unity is sort of optimized for modern stuff. So there isn't a really good tool set for that Quake era stuff. Now, you can use the Quake 2 engine, but you're going to be left with crappy, old-timey tools. You're not going to have good workflow. You're going to be messing around on the command line. You're going to be telling your artists, yeah, type this crap into a DOS box or stuff like that. At least I doubt there's like a nice workflow for that kind of work. I'll bet it feels kind of primitive and it's awkward. And you know, and that's hard to work with on those old things.
You were doing stolen pixels using the Hammer engine to make the Hammer tool set to make
the Hammer
the
level editor
talk
yes,
show
and
thing.
It's ghastly.
Which is the very Hammer much like a 90s style level editor.
Horrible, so bad. And just before that, I'd been using the Unreal editor, Unreal Ed. And that thing is just so amazing. I mean, Unreal, you click a few things, you make a box, and it turns into a room. You throw some crap in the corners, you put down a health kit and a gun, and you press the button, and boom, you're in the game playing the level. And you're in a little room, and there's light shining, and everything's cool. And the Hammer editor is such a pain in the ass. It's slower. It makes less good. It is more work to get the same amount of interestingness out of it. So much more work. If all you want is a cube room, it's going to take you 6 times as long, and you can't really see what it looks like. Maybe they've improved it since I used it. But yeah, the tools on those old systems suck, and you're not going to have a gorgeous level editor for your, you know, if you jump back to Quake 2 engine games. So that everything is against those that are first steps into 3D, the Quake era, Quake 3 Arena, even Deus Ex, the original Deus Ex, there just aren't good tools for doing that kind of stuff. Everything is pushing you either into pixel art or just into modern photorealistic 3D. Or you can do modern photorealistic 3D, except you don't go with the photorealistic. You throw a toon shader all over everything. But yeah, it would be more work to aim for those old chunky art styles. Dear Diecast Seers of the Spoiler, nowadays games have pretty advanced character creators. The results might usually be minimum, but we have sliders for everything from nose, bridges, length, to lip thickness. Hair, however, this is a sore spot with us. Hair, however, still seems to always be a simple choice between several models. If you're lucky, you can at least pick a variety of colors, but usually you're limited to things like mullet, ponytail, shaved, and mohawk. Why can't hair have the same
sliders?
Don't you
mean mohawk, 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 and mohawk?
And then bald, and then more mohawks, and then cornrows?
Yeah, and then like 15 different, like, almost bald variations.
Yeah, cornrows for my, you know, Skyrim or some kind of medieval game where you can have cornrows just for whatever reason. And then maybe one long hairstyle. It's just terrible. Why can't hair have the same sliders as a face? Why can't I have sliders for the length of my character's hair, or at least the length of the ponytail, or how shiny or opaque it is, or how messy or tidy? I guess this question is mostly directed at Seamus, but it still drives me mad sometimes. And what's up with Oblivion and facial hair anyway? Your Brazilian fan, RCN.
Don't you know? People in the medieval period never had facial hair at all, ever, in the history of everything. So as much as we make fun of games that do this, like, I kind of understand why. And that's because hair physics is fucking hard. I don't know if we turned on tress effects for the Tomb Raider season at all, like, while we were recording, but, like, and it didn't really work very well with my NVIDIA card because that game was optimized for AMD cards, but that was considered, like, advanced real-time hair physics, and it looks super dumb. Like, the hair has no weight, and it just kind of explodes everywhere periodically, and it's just, it's difficult to do this kind of stuff.
It like, flows yeah. Like water that's stuck to your head or something.
And it's, the other problem is, like, game developers like putting ridiculous, like, pauldrons and sticky bits on armor that clip a lot with long hair, which is why you see a lot of short hairstyles that look pretty ridiculous and, like, a ton of mohawks. But you can never have, like, just, like, shoulder-length hair on any character because it always seems to clip with the armor or whatever, and that's a concern.
Even though shoulder-length hair was probably the most common hairstyle throughout history.
Yeah, or longer. I mean, you know, you had people wearing headdresses and whatever throughout history, yeah. But...
The other thing is sliders are hard to do. I mean, making hair that grows in, like, you know, adjustable hair length and, oh, where's the part go? The face takes a long time to set up. I've actually made a character builder, and it took a long time to get all those sliders set up to tag them. Okay, this polygon belongs to this, and this polygon belongs to this slider, and it can move this far, and here's the parameters of how far and what angle, and oh, it's got to be different on this model and on this model. That is super, super pain in the ass, time-consuming, fiddly work that requires an artist and an engineer to work together. And
which is something you never want to have happening in your game development process.
The other problem is styles. I mean, if you start a slider for length and you have it all spiked up in a mohawk, all of the bits, all the polygons, because I'm assuming we're going to start from the basis of your hair is going to be polygons, not some sort of tress effects, pixel shadery, crappy thing. And if you're going with polygons, then the shader is going to basically equate to how long the hair polys have to be from the head. Except when you're talking about, like, a, you know, a ponytail, just the bit that is inside the ponytail, those polys have to go out longer. The rest of it should be very close to the head. Or if you have a mohawk, only the mohawky bit should go up, and they should go up, but not down, because mohawks are going to be spiked up. And if you have, like, a normal bob, it should just fall straight down around your head. And then there's the question of bangs, and whether you have bangs. Are bangs going to be a yes-no option, or are they going to have their separate slider? Just the amount of styles alone make what a slider would do very ambiguous.
Yeah, on one, you know, hair length, well, if with this hairstyle, length makes it longer down my body, but if I change to this hairstyle, all of a sudden length means taller? And that can be confusing in a lot of ways, yes. So on top of all that, it would almost be like every base hairstyle would need its own collection of sliders, which would just be this whole other dimension of complexity.
That reminds me of the Mountain Blade character creator, where facial width makes your head taller.
And if you do end up doing some sort of procedural hair generator where it takes into account hair length, style, whether there's bangs or not, size of the part, direction of the part, whether there's a cowlick, like a million and one different hair messiness factor that could maybe fuzziness factor. Like what's the hair's material? Is it a straight hair, thin hair, voluminous hair? Is it curly hair? All these things play into how hair actually ends up looking and behaving. And even if you had an algorithm that did all of that, it couldn't really be done with sliders. It would have to be some sort of procedural generation thing where you just sort of set the parameters of, I want, you know, ponytail hair with bangs, about 2/3 of the way of the slider full, generate that and tell me what that looks like. And that's what you would have to end up with. A slider, that's hard.
Damn, I would pay money for a DLC for The Witcher 3 that is the Geralt fashion model hairstyle set with, like, Fabio-level super voluminous hair, like a hairstyle commercial. And it's just Geralt running around with this super fabulous hair.
How about a Witcher game where I play a Geralt who doesn't make me physically ill?
Oh, but that wouldn't work as a dissonance anymore.
Did you not find the slider?
The hair.
Oh. It's one of the sliders there. At the beginning of the game, during the character creation stage, you have to take the skeeziness slider and put it all the way down Rutskarn. Did you not do that? Also, turn off, uncheck the box that says creepy asshole. You gotta uncheck that too.
Is there a neckline feature for the female character they introduced? Because I just keep thinking, Jesus, it's so cold out here.
Yeah, I mean, it goes all the way from plunging to navel, really. So you got your choice there.
You know, it's funny, actually, in the books, that character, there's a bit where that character of narration where it says that character is never going to wear a plunging neckline again because of a scar that she has there, which is just not reflected in the game at all.
Wait, what? Say that again?
So in the books, Triss has a scar on, like, her chest or neck, like upper chest area, and so it says in one of the books that she will never wear a plunging neckline again because of the scar, and that's just not in the game at all.
I really just don't understand how they, like, it's actually, like, kind of, I try to think of a way to put this. It's weird to see a studio these days that is quite so explicit at pushing the envelope of just being really off-puttingly, distractingly, gratuitously sexual with its female character representations. I know people will probably tell me they've gotten less so as the franchise has evolved, although I still, like, see character art and I'm like, it's kind of weird that this is just the normal thing in this game.
Oh, I just read, just before the diecast, I read an interview thing. It was about Witcher 3, and they were explaining why Witcher 2 opened with nudity. And they were like, we want to show that this is someone close to you, so that you'll be willing, if she gets in trouble, you'd be willing to go rescue her. Otherwise, you'd be like, well, who cares? Somebody got kidnapped. What do I care? So this was their way.
She's in bed, totally nude, and you're wearing pants.
And this is the Graham franchise, which showed you how close you were to, like, 40 different women by giving you playing cards of them naked after you have sex with them.
And, like, I don't object in principle to having this. I mean, okay, we have tits in movies. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
We have nudity. People get naked. And I want to stress that if you want to put naked people in your video game, that's fine. It's just weird to me that their first act of, like, well, how do we establish that you care about this person? And their first ink, like, the most obvious way to do it is you are naked in bed with them. Like,
you could put it very uncharitably and still just state the facts, which is they're trying to figure out, like, how do we establish that, like, how do we make the character, the players care about a woman and make them want to protect them? Show them the woman's tits. That's literally what they did. I mean, I know that, like, that's not how they thought about it, or that's not what they had in mind, but
they're trying
sort of
to
in a very practical sense. Yeah, the first thing that they could think of to make
like, to make the players connect with this person is to show them, like, in a moment of sexual intimacy with their protagonist, who they've already established as a player. It doesn't, like, it's sort of, they couldn't think of anything else to do.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the problem. Like, a part of me has a problem with all of the sort of backlash with The Witcher's, like, sexuality, and they're like, yeah, why the fuck not? Why can't we have sexuality in video games? You know, like, it's a thing that people do. People have sex. And we've got all these, like, you know...
Even if it is gratuitous, it, like, as long as it's labeled as such, I'm not against... Like, even if it's absolutely 100% gratuitous, that's fine. I mean, you know, men's entertainment by men for men, that's a real thing that exists. What weirds me out is this story that opens like that and then asks me to take it to take it seriously. That it took this really low road, and then all of a sudden it wants to turn around and, no, this isn't some Beatle movie schlock. This is a serious game about serious business, and maybe this is just the culture I grew up with, but that feels weird.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, the other part of me says, like, well, okay, but maybe you could, like, we could approach this in a less silly manner than we are right now. You know, maybe we could treat sex as something that is, you know, a mature topic. And I don't mean that in the fact that, like, it's for adults, but, like, that you know, it's not just this silly, like, ha-ha, tits kind of topic. You know,
if Geralt was naked too.
Lots of aspects to it beyond that.
If Geralt was also naked, I wouldn't have got the...
That would
hey,
go a long
way. Fans. Yeah, that would have given me, okay, this is too... Oh, and if there were blankets. The no blankets thing, I realize that's totally... It's totally unfair for me to pick on them for not having blankets. That's totally a technological issue. But the fact that there were no blankets and he had pants on felt very
Those
strange
pants
to me.
Were it, the fucking silliest part of the
I know, it immediately transformed what sequence. Should just be a couple of adults in the Middle Ages when they didn't have jammy jams. Just sleeping naked like you do. But it turns out, but he has pants on, so instead it's perceived as fan service. Yeah.
I mean, that would have established that these people are intimate together.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of...
It's like, does Geralt, like, wear those pants when he's having sex? Is that
is
like,
he,
his,
like,
his
super
thing?
Shy? Is he, like, super shy? And he's like, all right, look away. I'm going to turn off the light.
I think the biggest problem in games is not... It's like sometimes I complain about, you know, like, sexualization of video games, but it's not really that I care that people are making games that are sexy or even, like, making games that are fan service just for dudes or just for women. It's that I think when they do this, they sort of create a precedent that other people pick up on without really thinking about it. I think that people could stand to think about, well, wait a minute, am I creating fan service at this point? And is that something I actually wanted to do with the story that I'm trying to tell? Because I think, like, when I start playing The Witcher, and, like, there are four characters on screen, there's the guy who's dressed all in furs and, like, armor, there's the other guy who's dressed all in furs and armor, the other guy's dressed all in furs and armor, then there's, like, 50, like, mooks who are dressed in furs and armor, and then there's a woman who's got, like, this plunging neckline that shows, like, you know, the entirety of her chest. It's kind of like, I feel like they're using sort of different internal rules for what women are supposed to look like in a fantasy role-playing game, and I don't think they're really bothering to think about the effect, like, this might have in setting the mood or the tone of the game.
Exactly. It's like Lord of the Rings, but you have the guys who made Conan coming in and doing the art and costume design. It's like something is wrong here.
It's like if you just watched a movie and, you know, everything seems completely normal, and then the first male character shows up and he's like, you know, just sort of like wearing leather pants and like has an oiled chest, and he's a doctor in a hospital.
Conan the Barbarian, the doctor.
And, like, you realize, oh, this is fan service. You know, you could get over it, but, like, you're sort of thinking, did they even realize that it was fan service? That's when it starts to be a problem. I think my favorite example of this, which I've probably mentioned on the diecast before, is the Neverwinter Nights cover on Steam. Have I brought that up on the diecast before?
Yes. Okay. Yes, we had a long talk about it. The undead chick with her tits out. and rotting off face, but yes, turkey fleshy tits.
That was during the Skyrim season, actually. We were in some dungeon.
Well, we don't need to go through it again, but that yes. It's actually kind of funny.
You know, a game that does this really well is actually Dragon Age Inquisition. I mean, like, the earlier Dragon Age has always kind of handled it well, but, like, the earlier Dragon Age games still had, like, female armor that looked a bit ridiculous. Like, it wasn't skimpy or anything, but you had, like, shaped boobs, which is a bad idea.
And some of it wasn't ridiculous so much as it looked like it was designed in the 40s or something. Like, it looked to the male armor like 40s women's military uniforms looked to. And, you know, like, it wasn't a problem. I didn't think it was particularly egregious. I don't really know anybody who had a huge problem with it or thought it was too off-putting. But Inquisition's actually really good.
Cassandra's armor looks like real armor.
Yeah, I'll say one thing, which is that I always thought Morrigan's outfit was odd. Like, if she doesn't wear much, that's fine, although I kind of wonder how cold it is in the swamp and whether she might want to wear more, but I guess the idea is, I don't know. I'm not going to pick on it. But it always looked a little bit like this is held together with duct tape to me. Like, it looked like I didn't understand how it worked.
She had to tape that, like, her outfit had to be taped to her boobs, or every movement would have just been, she would have been hanging out all over the place, and she would constantly be adjusting herself.
She was actually wearing, like, a very small bikini top underneath that, but it's so small that you can't actually tell that she's wearing it.
Yes. And the thing is, like, also just that, like, you kind of wonder if maybe somebody else, like, would look at that outfit in the universe and just go, you know, like, what the fuck is she wearing?
Yeah, when everybody else...
Like, I don't even know if I would have wanted this, but it would have been funny if you'd gone into a tavern and somebody had just been like, what the fuck? Is the circus in town?
What is that you're not wearing? Or what are you barely wearing? All right. You know what? I kind of feel like that's a diecast.
That was a conversation that started on hair sliders and went into the role of sex in video games.
Way to go, you losers. You sidetracked everything again. You're all fired. I'm doing the show on my own from now on. Except for Campster, because he quit talking. He's allowed to be on the show.
Yay, I'm protected.
Oh, now you're fired.